don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. For the Lord's made a change in me.
Hello, this is Real History with Melissa, and today is the 5th of September, 2024, and I am joined by Nick Hayes from Hayes Reviews. Hey.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing very well today. Yeah, I'm very glad to be here. Very grateful for the invitation to have a conversation and talk about books, which is what I really love to do.
Good. Well, you just as we were getting ready to hit the record, you said that you were in the middle of moving house and you'd already packed up boxes and boxes of books. And what remains behind you is kind of a set that are yet to be packed. So,
yep, that's it. And these are all my favorite ones, I think, the ones behind me, the ones that I am very keen to read and cover and talk to people about that I've been collecting pretty much over the last 4 years. But I can get into a little bit more about why I started collecting these books and how I came to have so many. I can tell that story in a little more detail later on.
Well, why don't we start there?
Sure.
Just because before we start there, I just wanted to say that I have made the acquaintance of the good work that Nick is doing from the CTTM book club on Telegram. And you joined that group and you've been a huge participant, just amazing. And you've shared the work that you're doing on your Hayes Reviews channels. So right now I'm looking at your YouTube channel. And the book that you've been covering right now is called The Fearful Master by G. Edward Griffin. That was 1964. And then before that, you covered The Next Million Years by Charles Galton Darwin. And longtime listeners to Alan are going to know all about that book. Then you covered a book called The Story of the Rockefeller Foundation. And I had not heard of this book, but it's by Raymond B. Fosdick, 1952. And you also covered, I've listened to about an episode and a half of this and just wished that I had more time, when you covered Fabian Freeway by Rose L. Martin, 1966. So you read and discuss some really excellent books on your channel. And like I see, I think you're doing two recordings a week. Is that right?
Three.
Oh my goodness. So, no wonder I can't keep up.
Not many people can, but it's all there archived and downloaded and ready to go for people, you know, in the bank. So if you can't make it live, don't worry. The replays are always available.
Oh, that's great. So tell me how you got into books at this level and what prompted you starting to read and discuss them on your channels.
Absolutely. So I have to go way back to when I was very young. And like all children at various times in their childhood growing up, I think you might get fed up and a little bit lethargic. And you might say to your parents, "Mom, Dad, I'm bored." And my mom's stock reply to this was always, "Only boring people get bored. Go and read a book." And so I took this word to heart. And from a very young age, I would read. And that would be...
I like your mother.
Yeah.
Just
Me too, very much. I have a lot to be grateful for with her as my mother, that's for sure. And so I got into this habit very young. And in fact, one of the books that I read as a, I would say, when I was in secondary school, a young teenage kind of age, was 1984 by George Orwell. And it went way over my head. I didn't have the maturity or the life experience or the context to really understand it then. But this love of reading went on. And I was very much interested in fiction, novels. I got very into the novels of Louis de Bernier, who wrote Captain Corelli's Mandolin, which is a fantastic novel about love and loss and war and all these kind of things wrapped up into this really punchy, hilarious, heartbreaking novel. And I also got into other books like P.G. Woodhouse, the English hilarious stories of and the way he writes, the turns of phrase he uses, very entertaining. And so to complement this, while I was going through my schooling, I tended to be pretty good at English and the English literature classes in particular. And so I did an A level in English literature, and this teacher whom I had at that time was so uplifting and inspiring that she basically talked me into going to university to carry on studying English literature, which I did. So then I enrolled and went to the University of Liverpool, and there I was studying English lit. But then I started leaning more towards poetry. I got very much into crime fiction as well. So Sherlock Holmes, short stories, Arthur Conan Doyle were a real big favorite of mine. And I also got very interested in the poetry of William Blake. And that's relevant to the CTTM book group because you had a conversation with Andrea very recently, and she's also a big fan of art, and William Blake was an artist. And so we've had some good conversations there, a nice synchronistic crossing of interests. And then I went kind of on through life, moving around, doing various jobs, and always going into secondhand bookshops and grabbing novels off the shelf that looked interesting. And that continued up until the, what year would it be, 2020, when we lockdowns began, and we got kind of suddenly coerced and into having to spend much more time at home. I was fortunate in that I had a job which required me to be there in person. I was taking care of vulnerable adults at the time, so I was still required to leave my home and go to work, and I was kind of on the front line of things, not in the hospital sense, but in the sense of working with vulnerable adults and having to don and doff the PPE, which were two new words that I learned. I was like learning new words. I didn't know you could don and doff things until that point. At that time, I started asking a lot of questions and being very confused. I didn't know what was going on, and it didn't seem to make sense to me what we were being told through our mainstream channels. A lot of the guys I was working with and looking after watched a lot of television, where I didn't really, but I would catch a lot of these 6 o'clock nightly news reports. And I thought, this doesn't make sense. These reports don't seem to be geared towards fostering health and wellness and well-being. They look a little more fearful and scary and intimidating, and numbers and graphs and all this sort of thing. And so I went kind of searching for alternative interpretations of what was going on, and very quickly found a number of YouTube channels and alternative content creators who were giving a lot of context around the events that was not being included in the mainstream news. And so to mention a few channels such as The Last American Vagabond or James Corbett, and at some point James Corbett was talking to a gentleman called Richard Grove, who runs a podcast called Grand Theft World, and that's still ongoing every Sunday night. And they had this 2-hour conversation in which they were talking to each other about books, and they were kind of having a, hey, have you read this one? And what about this one? And did you know? And they were throwing back, and I was listening to the things they were discussing, and I thought, why do I not know about any of this stuff? Why was this, like, how did I not know about something like Operation Paperclip, right? I just couldn't believe that I got to like over 30 years old and no one had ever mentioned that to me, and I never learned about it. But there's books out there written about this. So I thought, okay, I might have to start getting some of these books, right? So I started going to secondhand bookshops in the town I was living in, which had a university. And this is a really good tip. If you live in a place near a university, the secondhand bookshops tend to have good things in them because the university libraries are always upgrading their contents and getting rid of old stuff. And in the era we live in, which is increasingly 1984, thought police, you know, get rid of certain things and put them in the memory hole, this can be really advantageous to those of us who have a, you know, a few pounds to and some time to go through those secondhand bookshops and grab what's there. And so I found a book for the paperclip called The Paperclip Conspiracy. And it was by a mainstream author, and I just got it there off the shelf, and I thought, this is blowing my mind. And you get in the book and you read it and you realize there's all these other references to other books and other documents, and this just opened up my whole worldview to this totally neglected area that had never been spoken to me about, and no one knew, seemed to, no one in my circles seemed to know about this stuff. And I had to dig around and go into the kind of censored recesses of the internet to find people talking about these things. And then kind of at the same time as that, I was seeing people getting deplatformed. I was seeing people get their channels hit with censorship strikes and community guideline violations. And they were having, being kicked off Facebook, kicked off YouTube. And so I thought, do you know what? I'm going to make an effort to collect as many of these books as I can, because if I have them in my house, you know, short of the somebody kicking the door down and coming in and invading my home and taking them off me, I have them there and I can refer to them and I can learn from them and I can talk to other people about them, even if the censorship ramps up and gets crazy and we do end up in a kind of Fahrenheit 451 type scenario. So that was my thinking, really, just a concern about levels of censorship and a desire to gather information that was relevant. Because I thought, if I didn't know about this, then there must be, I don't know how many people out there who don't know about this and who would probably like to know about it. And so that's why I started collecting the books. And then around probably January, I think this year, I started live streaming. And initially I was going through news articles, mainstream news articles. And then I was contrasting mainstream news articles to some alternative sources. And I was trying to take people on this journey of starting with mainstream headlines and then going to these alternative places where you get maybe a different view on things. And I did that for a while, and I got some good feedback and a few donations. And with the donations to the channel, I bought a book cam. And when the book cam came, I thought, right, now I can just read these books. And
you bought a what?
A book cam. You can see it here. Here's my book cam. So this is my camera, and I just hold the book underneath it, and then people can.
I didn't know that that was what that was called. It was a special thing, a book cam. Okay, cool.
Yeah, or a document cam, it might be called. Yeah. So that cost me, I don't know, about £150 or something. And then my show changed. And so then I decided, right, I'm going to live stream these books. I'll read them, books I haven't read. And we can do it with anyone who shows up, and we can have a back and forth and have a learning experience together. And it's really great, because when I come across words I can't pronounce or I've never heard of, then people in the audience can look them up for me and help me to pronounce them properly. So it's really, it's a good thing to do live. And it's been a really edifying and entertaining and fun journey. And as you mentioned at the start and asked me about the video output, I do three a week. I try to do three a week, because otherwise it takes too long to get through a book. Mm-hmm. And I think we've done 9 books now on the channel. And the 10th one we've got lined up is going to be a real humdinger. So yeah.
Have you announced it? Or
yeah, I've got it. Okay. I've got it right here. I can show it now. And this book is The Milner-Fabian Conspiracy. And in the intro to this book, he says that he's following on the work from Carol Quigley in Tragedy and Hope and Rose Martin of Fabian Freeway, which we've already read on the
great.
Channel. And he said,
I'm going to make a point to try to keep up on this one, because that looks great.
This is going to be a good one for sure. It's really hard to find. There's maybe 10 copies available online that I can find. And they cost between $80 and $300. I bought it a long time ago when it was much cheaper. But nowadays it's, I don't know if that's deliberate, if it's getting memory hold, or if just people are onto
it. It is deliberate. And I'll just say that I won't be purchasing a copy at that price. I'll depend on you and your book cam. But one thing, I was just listening to an old talk of Alan Watts the other day, in which he mentioned a book. It might have been Tragedy and Hope. And this was years ago. This was about an 18-year-old talk. And he said, I'm careful about how I talk about a book, because I've noticed when I talk about a book, the price mysteriously skyrockets, and even availability of something that wasn't that hard to get a hold of all of a sudden mysteriously becomes difficult to get a hold of. And I think that's true. I mean, I know that maybe you have not considered this, but even though your channels aren't huge with huge subscribers, what you're doing will be noticed, not just algorithmically. It will be noticed by people who pay attention. And if you mention a book, it may well be that it's going to go up in price. You see what I mean?
No,
It's
absolutely.
censorship is very real, and there are, it's short of, kicking your door in Fahrenheit 451 style, they can just drive the price of the books up and make them hard to get a hold of.
And they're even doing that now on Archive, the online archive. I think it's
Yes.
archive.org, and they say
Yeah.
you have to rent the book as though it's a library,
Yes.
but there's
Yeah.
only limited numbers of these digital books, and you have to renew them every hour pending
Yes.
availability.
Yes. I mean, when I first started using Internet Archive, that was not the way. You could find pretty much anything that you wanted. Now, when they say rent, I mean, I have never actually paid for a book, but I did sign up with a, an email address and a password, and I borrow the book. And, I have to hit it. If I need it for more than an hour, I have to, keep borrowing it again every hour on the hour. So that's, and the other thing too, I was looking at a more scholarly work, an article, and I ended up having to sign up for something. I mean, it was a freebie, but I don't like giving my information out, just to any, but it's one technique of censorship is put it behind a paywall. Another technique is you've got to log in, give a little bit of your personal information if you want to borrow that. But you'll find so much good material is only available on things like, oh, Oxford or Scribd or Cambridge or, things that you have to sign into if you want to see it. So it's good that you're doing this. It's
I do worry sometimes that, I'm letting the cat out of the bag by putting all these books in one place and talking about them and, maybe driving the price up. But like we mentioned at the start, I think before we came on, the person who helped you move said when he helps people move, people rarely have collections of books these days. So there are really not that many people doing it, like collecting books and building up libraries in the same way. And the way I look at it is, well, there's not much point in me having these books and just sitting on them. I've got to try and get them out and help other people to benefit from the contents. And the other thing is, it keeps me accountable because if I know I've got live streams, instead of doing something else that evening, I sit down and I get a few chapters read, and it keeps me in the book and making sure I'm getting the readings done too. So I kind of look upon it like I'm sort of helping people, and I hope I'm not doing too much damage with driving prices up.
I think at this point, I mean, that is a, Alan always reminded us that we had a set limited time with the internet, and that has turned out to be true. He said about 20 years, and if you think of all of the censorship and the care that you have to exhibit and the just I saw a clip that was going around. I don't know where Donald Trump said this or when he said it, but he was saying, yes, of course, we have to have censorship. I'm not sure he used that word, but we have to control the internet in some way. And so that window that Alan always predicted we would have, that is closing very rapidly. And so at this point, I'm less concerned about driving a price up. I don't need a copy of the book if you're talking about it. That's good enough for me. But one thing that I'll just share on this vein, this morning I started listening to a talk of Alan's that he did at near the beginning of 2020, Operation 2020. And it was from February the 2nd, 2020, entitled A Perfect Storm. Chinese traveling at New Year, party and song, happy reunions, then fear as it all went wrong. And so as I was listening, he said something that I thought, oh, this is definitely a keeper. I'll see if I can just pull it right up here again. He said, he got right in there, and remember, this is the early 2020, but he got right in there sharing an article in the mainstream media about the challenges of deep fakes. So immediately they were planting the idea that you can't trust what you're seeing, that misinformation, the internet is rife with misinformation. And he was reading the article, I can post it with this talk. It was from an innovation summit that was being held, and the woman said, this is the challenge of deep fakes. Over the past decade, social media has provided a rich source of news for media companies. Yet the phenomenon of fake news, and in particular, the emergence of deep fakes, has meant that organizations have had to tweak their approach. And Alan said, it isn't just about photographs and things like that and voices, which they can fake. Of course they can, but it's really about managing things in real time. You'd be surprised how many of these organizations are attached to this particular organization at the moment. The organization was called the UGC, a news gathering branch of Reuters. So he said it's a global system on the go watching social media. And Alan continued, and sure, there's going to be a lot of iffy things, but I really believe that no matter how crazy some of the stuff out there is, it shouldn't be censored. Really don't believe anything should be censored at all. I really don't. Give the people some credit for thinking for themselves and deciding for themselves. You've got to, if you want to have a free society. He paused. We don't have a free society. What am I kidding? I'm not kidding about that at all. We don't have a free society at all. Of course we don't. So that there we are. Our window is closing, and I've had a sense of urgency, obviously, for years, but especially since Alan's passing, and looking around and seeing how quickly things are moving, that any of us who have the voice and the and by that, I just mean the willingness to use our voice and what we know and where we are, because I'm sure that you've had this thought cross your mind before in some form or another. Do I really know enough to be sitting behind a mic and talk, you know, that
100% every single time, you know, even before this call, I was like, do I know enough about, but that's why I thought bringing the books in the way I do. You know, it's not about me so much. It's more about like, okay, what did this author do? What did this researcher say? And then I'm just adding my thoughts and connections as they come along. But I certainly have that self-talk very often. But again, that's why I try and make it, okay, let's do it about the books. And if we focus on there, and I make quite long form videos, which I think most people will not bother to engage with. And so only the people who have the attention span and the willingness and the intention to find information will stick with it and get the benefit. And so I think that acts as a sort of filter, which helps me sort of fly under the radar. I'm never going to be hitting hundreds of thousands of views and millions of subs and followers and all that. But I think through word of mouth and people being drawn to Alan's long form talks, for example, or the work of, let's say, Richard Grove, who I've been sort of studying under as well the last few years and mentoring under. This long form content is self-selecting in a way, and it helps keep the censorship trolls at bay to a certain degree, I think. But I do agree with you that with regards to the window closing, and also I think we've got to be hyper skeptical of any audio and video and imagery that we see online now, as Alan was saying. And I don't know what the answer is to that, because people have been, in many cases, so conditioned to only look at things that are super slick and polished and well produced with all these cuts and effects and sound effects, so that it's very overwhelming and kind of a sensory overload in a lot of ways, that one person talking for 3 hours or 1 hour even, or 30 minutes. And, oh, I don't have 30 minutes to spend on that. Give me the 30-second clip where it's flashy and amazing, and there's all this showing off going on. So yeah, it's kind of alarming, but I think those of us who stick to the long form stuff, we've got an advantage in a sense.
I think so too. And it might have been the Redux that I put up on Sunday, or maybe just another random talk that I was listening to. But Alan made a point about popularity. And I cannot recall his words exactly, but it's basically if it's popular, if it has a huge audience, one should be cautious, dubious, questioning. So it seems to be, unfortunately, human nature gravitates towards the popular, the famous, the well-financed, and so forth. But just as a rule of thumb, if it's popular, I go, I wonder why. Who's made that popular? So I don't mind being unpopular.
Me neither. It's a badge of honor for sure. Because what the other
Unsubscribe.
unsubscribe. Yeah, I've got too many followers. But because I was talking about this in my Telegram group, and I was mentioning how because of the censorship and knowing some content creators and broadcasters have been kicked off, say, Patreon or PayPal and YouTube, and then others have been allowed to stay on. It's very interesting to look at those patterns and ask that question. Well, apparently this character is giving us truth and calling, speaking truth to power and calling out the events of the last 4 years and poking holes in the official narratives. But they haven't been, but they're allowed to be on Patreon and they're allowed to have hundreds of thousands of subs on YouTube versus someone else who's ostensibly doing the same thing. They get kicked off. So it's very interesting. And I totally agree with Alan's sentiment there that if it's popular, ask why. Always ask the question, why am I seeing what I'm seeing? And be very vigilant with regards to your diet. And you know, the word diet always has connotations of food and drink, but really it should have anything we listen to, anything we watch. You know, that's all going in to our minds and it's informing our worldview. And one of the things that I love that Alan says many times is how television and film, it's not about the story. We stick around to watch the story and see the outcome. And is the hero going to win? And is the bad guy going to get caught? But what we're actually getting is we're downloading ways to behave, ways to interact, phrases to say, ways to answer questions and patterns, which we then replicate in our real life with our interactions with real people around us. That's what it's
Monkey
actually
see,
for.
monkey
Monkey see,
see.
monkey do. Yeah. And so that blows my mind now. And I'm very, you know, I'm trying to convince my wife to let me just not have a TV in our new place. I'm like, we don't need the TV.
Okay.
We should
All
just
right.
throw it
You
away.
just made the segue for the personal question that I wanted to ask you. So you said it. You said you had a wife.
Go
So
on.
how, when you reached this point 4 years ago, were you married at that time, where you started to look at the book collection? Okay. And what did your wife think about your decision to do this, the time that you were spending on it? What was her reaction, if I may?
You may. Absolutely. So the timeline was incredibly, I don't know, you know, I thank God or the universe or the synchronicity or the mystical powers of the universe and the way it organizes, whatever. But we got married in about 2 or 3 months before the event, the Big C event began, and we were not allowed to leave our homes. And we had just moved in together, and we had just moved in. We didn't have a lot of money, and we just moved into a shared house, and it was on a village outside the city, up a hill, and it had a big garden, and it looked down in over the city. It was a beautiful view, but it was out of the way, and we didn't have a car, and we just moved in there, and then all this event started happening, and I was obsessed listening to, you know, interviews and trying to get to the bottom of it. And I just said, and I'm very blessed and very lucky that she believed and trusted in my ability to reason things out. And so when I was saying, look, we gotta, I want to get these books. I think they're going to be I say it's going to be an investment. And because the price of some of the books that I've bought over the last 4 years have gone up, you know, the one I just showed you, that's almost double now what I paid for it. Well, 10, it's 10 times more if you take the upper limit of what people are trying to sell it for. And that's the case on quite a lot of these books I have. So I'm saying, so that was an angle. I'm like, hey, it's an investment, you know? You know? And then the other thing was when I started the channel and the YouTube, and she saw how much I loved reading and how passionately intense I was about this information and getting it out to people, and how much I loved the actual process of live streaming and interacting, then she kind of said, you know, this, she got on board and really supports that mission. I think she can see that it lights me up, and she can see that it is very much aligned with my values and my kind of sense of purpose in life. And so she's very understanding, and she just has a caveat that as long as, you know, I'm allowed to have my library in the house, as long as she has one whole room for her handbags. And I think that's a fair trade-off.
Aha, so she's a negotiator.
Very much so.
I suppose any good wife ought to be.
It's a give and take thing.
That's good. That's good. I was just curious about that because, as we know, sadly, a lot of relationships did not survive the big C. And some are still in the process of disintegrating. I just heard from a lovely person that has been communicating with Alan for years and years. And it's sad to see long time relationships just crumble under the stresses, and primarily the fact that both partners did not see eye to eye about what was going on.
That's absolutely a huge thing. Yeah. It's heartbreaking too, and I think one of the deliberate intentions of that whole operation was to do just that exact thing. Mm-hmm. Because we know that the traditional institutions of marriage and monogamy have been under attack for a long, long time through a variety of mechanisms and programs, and this was another way to really drive home that wedge. And I talked to people as well who vehemently disagreed, and people went off and did things without the consent or the knowledge of their partners. And I'm just so blessed and grateful that we managed to remain on the same page. And I was doing the lion's share of the learning throughout, because I was doing a lot of bike riding at the time, because I had a 40-minute bike ride to work and back. So every time I was on my bike, I had headphones in and I would listen to all manner of different speakers, and nothing added up. And so I'm just very lucky and very blessed that I could communicate that. And I have picked a wife who trusts in my sort of ability to discern. And also, I think when I voiced what I'd learned and pointed out the holes and the gaps and the contradictions and the nonsensical things, she kind of said, yeah, you're right. That doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And so she could start to see it as well, and had the same idea as me, is that once you can see it, you can't unsee it. And so right. I very much helped get her to that point. Cause I was, for all intents and purposes, fast asleep. I was just a normie, no plans, no understanding of the big picture, how the world works, nothing until that happened. And then I started paying attention and trying to learn. And so she was kind of coming along that journey with me at the same time. And mm-hmm. and we were watching all whatever was coming out. And I won't name names in case we get stuck in the algorithm ghetto or something, but
indeed. So we're chatting along and we have not talked yet. Neither one of us has said Animal Farm. So this, we wanted to talk about George Orwell's Animal Farm. And I think, I'm not exactly sure how this happened, but at some point on the Telegram Book Club channel, you said in the chat that you had never read Animal Farm. And I saw that and I said, oh, Nick, come and do a real history with me, and you will read Animal Farm. I will reread it and we will discuss it. And you said, great. And so that's what we did. So I have read it, I don't know how many times, several times, but I did read it again, and I listened to an audiobook coverage of it. And this is the version that I read. And it is, I'm just mentioning this to you because I got fixated on a few things. This is published by Penguin Group, and the printing is 2003. So I'm saying some names because those are important. So it's this edition, and it had a foreword I don't have a book cam now. I'm envious of the book cams. It had a foreword by Anne Patchett. And she is a popular novelist here in the U.S. So we can come back to there's a foreword in here. There's a preface by Russell Baker. And guess what? The introduction years ago, the introduction was by a C.M. Woodhouse.
All right. Very nice synchronicity.
Yeah. So then I thought, well, I had just grabbed that one off the shelf, but I had about five different versions. And when I was reading something, I discovered, I think it was in this version here, it was mentioned in the introduction that Orwell had written, they said, a thankfully unpublished preface to Animal Farm entitled The Freedom of the Press. And the reason why they were happy that he didn't publish it is they said, when he makes his thoughts about what was going on in Russia and everything so specific that it would have detracted from the reading. You're able to read the book at any point in time, and you don't have to know what readers all knew at that time. Oh, this is about Stalin. This is about Russia. This is about the Soviet Union. This is about these events that have played out between Stalin and Trotsky. You know, so it, in other words, without his preface that he didn't publish, it was better because it made it more universal. So, but it was interesting to go back and reread that. So we can come back to prefaces and introductions, but I would love to hear what you thought about this book.
All right. Well, first, thank you for the invitation, because I don't know when I would have gotten around to reading it, because as I mentioned, I started off with novels, somehow skipped over this one. And nowadays I'm reading a lot more history and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So it was really nice actually to take a break from my usual sort of criticisms of the UN and history of the Fabian Society type books to get into this. And I absolutely loved it. It blew my mind how concentrated and focused every detail seemed significant. Mm-hmm. And it really was. And given the events of the last 4 years and my recent reading into Fabian socialism and its connections with communism, I thought it was just an incredible encapsulation of this cycle of tyrants replacing tyrants, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, and how that is done and how people are taken in many ways. And so I thought it was great. It touched on so many aspects that, and it felt like a very, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of a comprehensive, there didn't seem to be much missing from it, really. I wasn't thinking, oh, it needs a bit of this or that. I felt it flowed very well. It had its ups and downs, its moments of humor. It had its heartbreaking moments. It had its tense moments. It had its kind of slap yourself in the forehead moments because of the gullibility and stupidity of some of the animals and the way they're taken in. But then it also had these incredible insights into human nature. And I think that's ultimately the power of what he did here, is that he's using animals. And of course they're anthropomorphized, but he's woven this magical spell of animals that are both human and retain their animal natures as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's incredible. And I think the number of levels it works on, you could probably give it to a very young reader and they would be entertained and find some fun in it. But then you could give it to a historian of Russia and the Russian Revolution, and they will see that deeper meaning. I'm not such an expert on the Russian Revolution, but for me, it was like, oh, this is how events and operations such as we've just lived through are carried out. And this is the qualities of human nature that allow that to take place. That's what I kind of took away from it.
That is interesting. Yeah. I agree. I mean, it had been a few years. I had seen a filmed version of it in the last few years, but it had been quite a number of years since I had read the book. And I forgot how many laugh out loud moments there are. Just brilliant humor in there, but also incredible tragedy. I mean, it really takes you on a ride, and I think that that is the truth of what people experience when they're victimized by some kind of totalitarian regime. You know, it's you're taken on a ride. You have a lot of belief in it. Unfortunately, he shows a truth there, which is very, very few people, if any, see through it. Very few animals see through it, right down to the end where they're taking Boxer away, and they, you know, the excuse is, well, of course, you know, the veterinarian, the hospital just had to buy the truck and they hadn't had time to repaint it. So he didn't really go to the knacker's yard. That's just, how could you even think that we would do something like that? And that's how propaganda plays on us. We're gaslit all the time with it. So if we think for ourselves and challenge the narrative, the immediate response in these systems is, what would make you think a thing like that?
How dare you? Well, I mean, what did we've been nothing but good and generous and kind to you. We've got your best interests at heart. And yeah, that's a really good point. One of the themes that I picked up on was memory. And that came through really strongly a number of times because famously in the book, they have the seven commandments of animalism, which get written on the side of the barn. But there's a problem because most, if not the majority of the animals can't read. And some of them can read a few letters. One of them learns, one of them, the horse, which is very vain, only learns the letters in her own name. And there's the part where Boxer, the hardworking, like stout and muscly work horse, he only learns the first four letters of the alphabet and he struggles to learn the next four. And when he does learn the next four, he's forgotten the first four. And so he just makes peace with the fact that they only ever know the first four letters of the alphabet. So,
And it's heartbreaking at the end because he's looking forward to retirement when he can learn the remaining letters of the alphabet. That's
yeah,
his big goal.
that's what he's going to do in his retirement. Yeah, and so there's like an exploitation of innocence in there as well. But to go back to the memory issue, they write these commandments on the wall of the barn. And then something happens where an animal breaks one of them. And most of the animals, they can't remember. And only if small, maybe it's even one, just one animal says, hang on a second, didn't one of the commandments say that the animal shouldn't drink alcohol? And then that animal can't read. So they have to drag another animal who can. And they say, can we just read that to me again? And they read that commandment out and it says, no animal shall drink alcohol to excess. And it's been updated. And this happens with four, I think, of the commandments. And so there's this rewriting of history. You can tell it's a similar theme that is in 1984, Orwell's other masterpiece and celebrated book, things getting memory holed and the history being rewritten and people's names being crossed out and therefore they never existed because they're not in any of the books written about the history, right? So there's this gaslighting, there's this exploiting of innocent, simple-minded folk who just assume the best in other people. Like I would never do that, so why would Napoleon the pig lie? Because I would never lie, so why would, you know, the people in charge lie? They just wouldn't do that. There's no reason to do it. And they have this sort of projection of how they live onto everyone else, not realizing that there's psychopathic, manipulative, power-hungry totalitarians out there who will do anything and everything to gain that power and keep hold of it. So that really stood out to me as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's interesting. And they're all, you know, you've got the useful idiots too. They're not at the top, but they're happy to, you know, Moses, they're gonna go along, and whatever's happening, That's who they are, and that's who they're with. They're the ones who, even Molly in her own way, I mean, you can't hate Molly too much, but she's just not a revolutionary. She
No.
likes sugar and ribbons, and she'll go where the sugar and ribbons are.
That's funny, because Melissa, I was looking at your most recent Real History episode to make sure I could sort of record this one in a way that similar sort of format. And I just clicked into a random part in the video, and the part of the video I clicked into, you were talking about how, and I have no idea what the context was, but you were saying something about how about loving an idiot. And how, sometimes you love an idiot, you just can't help it, right? And it was just funny that I checked that clip out, and that's what Molly's like. She's this
Yes.
just sort of simple, innocent. She's a bit vain, but she just wants some sugar and some affection and a pat on the head and to look pretty. And that's that. And she's never going to understand, the commandments of animalism and these theories and the class struggle and the sort of use of propagandistic methods to rile up somebody to violent action or to work far past their limits or to tolerate, being exploited in the way the other animals do. I think she just does she just disappear at some point? She's accepting ribbons and sugar from the neighbor farm, and then they stop talking about her and she disappears, I think is what happens.
Yeah, I think she ended up pulling cart or something for a neighboring farm, with and she had fresh ribbons, you know. So
Well,
she's
that's it.
oblivious to the struggle.
It reminds me a little bit of the Matrix scene where Morpheus is saying some people are just so hopelessly dependent upon the system that there is no way to get them to wake up or exit it or to see the injustice or the violence inherent in that system because they don't want to see it. And you can't make a person see
Yes.
something they don't want to.
That's interesting. Well, I said that I got sidetracked. Now, I don't know who C.M. Woodhouse is. And when I first read that, you know how sometimes you just see what you want to see, you know? And so I thought they were talking about P.G. Woodhouse. And I thought, oh, cool. You know, that's an interesting choice for the introduction, but it's C.M. Woodhouse. I think he might have written something about the Greeks. It's not the same person. I don't know if he's related to P.G. Woodhouse, but I liked the comments that he made. And I was thinking at the time, like it was P.G. Now, P.G. Woodhouse, who wrote the Jeeves novels, which is a really funny examination of class. You have the sort of hapless, almost idiot, just completely silly toff. He's an elite. He's got the right name. He was born in the right circumstances, and his butler, or his valet, I guess, his personal valet is Jeeves, and they've made tons of movies with this and TV series, and the novels are hilarious. It's been years since I read them, but that's who I thought we were talking about. And that Woodhouse spent the war partly incarcerated in Germany. He had left England because of tax burden and lived with his wife in France, and then had ended up in Germany during the war, and had received a lot of flack from his fellow Englishmen and even some Americans. There were excuses made and so forth. He was defended. But because he had done a series of kind of humorous broadcasts on the radio out of Germany, and he was accused of treason, and it all blew over and everything. So I thought, well, that's an interesting choice for the introduction. But then I looked at it a little bit later, and I'm like, I don't know who C.M. Woodhouse is.
That's amazing, though. I didn't know
Nor,
all that about PG Woodhouse.
yeah, and very interesting. And in a way, when I was looking at this is an aside having to do with nothing, but he struck me almost, Woodhouse, as a kind of Molly, because he, unlike his felt the intelligentsia, he was just someone who liked to write novels. He was they were entertaining. He was not political in his lifetime. Everybody said he was not political. and he wanted to do this, and they all at that time, I think the mood was you have to be, if you're a novelist, if you're writing, you have to be political. You have to be putting your talents towards politics. So he was Molly, no, I just, I want my sugar and my ribbons. But the so that was whoever C.M. Woodhouse was, that was at the right, oh, within 10 years of the publication of the novel. And then it had a preface by Russell Baker. And Russell Baker wrote a lot of things. And so I was just trying to think the timing of when they wrote, what did they say? So the preface here is by Russell Baker, and he said a few things that I thought were interesting. He said Orwell with Animal Farm in 1984 and Arthur Koestler with Darkness at Noon were read on campuses everywhere, and so spread a mood of pessimism, which was probably responsible for a great deal of the intellectual community's enthusiasm for the Cold War. Aldous Huxley's utopian Brave New World, with its portrait of a heavily drugged society easily manipulated by politicians, also had considerable vogue in this era. What all had in common was a depressing pessimism about the future. Like so much other writing of the era, they rested on the assumption that individuals were no match for the efficient new technology at the disposal of totalitarian politicians. It was pre-2001. I made a note in the book. He goes on to write, well, here we are in that future that so many writers 50 years ago could only guess at. And what do we see? They were ludicrously wrong about the amazing efficiency with which totalitarians would destroy individualism. Why did they get it all wrong? And I thought, okay, I am going to let that one go because he wrote this in 1999. This was before you could have just been kind of going along as a normie. And you don't have all of the total war on terrorism, everything that happens post 2001. So I'll let it go. He goes on to even say it's just kind of fantastic, some of the stuff in there that in 1984. 1984, television makes it possible for Big Brother to watch everybody all the time. Huxley's Brave New World hints at the power of drugs to keep people permanently pacified. So that is what Russell Baker wrote in 1996, what for that publication, pre-2001. Then we get to the very first, the new foreword is by Ann Patchett. And I, like you, I have not read novels in a long time. I've been, with Alan, we read some of the Sherlock Holmes stories. That was a pastime, and some Philip K. Dick. But for the most part, it was all nonfiction all the time. So I haven't been keeping up with who's trendy, who's being pushed, who's on the New York Times bestseller list of, popular novels and so forth. But Ann Patchett, as it turns out, is a highly regarded, very popular novelist. And she wrote her foreword in 2003. And the more that I read it, and she wrote it, she said that this was in her library when she was a schoolgirl, so young. And Animal Farm was not part of my library as a like a preteen. It was not a child, it was not considered a children's book. It's something that you read, but not when you were 9 or 10 or 11. So she said, she asked the question in 2003, how does it wind up in the hands of every sixth grader? And then she answers that question. She said, one obvious part of the answer is that Orwell's vision of the future never came to pass. Had the year 1984 resembled its namesake novel in any way, the collected works of George Orwell would have been the first things stoked into the furnace of the revolution. And as a matter of fact, these things I noticed in the UK, that Orwell, along with Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, can put you on a watch list of a type in the UK.
So, yeah, far right extremism. Mm-hmm,
exactly. So she goes on to, and then she made a few more comments here. I'm looking to see. Oh, she talks about everything in 1984, the idea that everything was subject to change and how ludicrous this appears to her in 2003. She said, laws can change, ideas, words, concepts. And I wrote a note in the margin, and there are two words I'm not going to say aloud, but the very definition of the word that defined that C that started in 2020, the very definition was changed in real time before our eyes, as was the definition of for victory. You had a completely new definition of what that was supposed to do. And the more that I read her schoolgirl enthusiasm for a children's fairy story that had nothing whatsoever to do with reality, the more I said to myself, well, I must look up Ann Patchett. And what I discovered about her, she's very highly regarded, a Penn Faulkner prize winner. These are the top literary prizes in the US. She has spoken or hosted at the Aspen Institute, their Winter Words Festival twice, another one of their festivals. So she's got a huge career, but I kept wanting to know what she thought about the year of C. And I never really could answer that to my satisfaction. But in digging around for it, like, I did discover that she was married to a medical doctor. I think Harvard trained medical doctors. So we know how most people of that profession responded and where they guided us. I kept digging though, who, you know, what did Ann Patchett have to say? And I finally found a long essay, which I did not have time to read, but I skimmed through it and I got the particulars of it, that she had written about being in lockdown with Tom Hanks' assistant, Suki, who was dealing with cancer, who she had met at an event that she had been asked to host, to be the interviewer, to talk to Tom Hanks about his collection of short stories that he had just published. So this just spun me way out there in terms of authorized entertainment, because we can't forget that authors are authorized, as Alan liked to point out, particularly novelists, but all authors. Who ran the Aspen Institute for years was Walter Isaacson, and he is the authorized biographer of Jennifer Doudna, CRISPR technology, Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, Einstein.
I'm just writing his name down because I had not heard of him before.
Walter Isaacson. Yeah, I had actually posted an interview that he did on NPR shortly after Alan passed away, because he was talking about let's just call it the alphabet technology that we all learned about during C. And he had written, you know, Doudna's book is about alphabet technology in part. And I thought that these articles were, you know, well worth, I'm like, okay, post them. And that was back in maybe late April of 2021, I posted those and I revisited them, but I really didn't know who he was. I hadn't followed Aspen Institute. I don't read those kind of biographies. And when I finally discovered, I thought he might be a scientist. Why else would he be talking about alphabet technology being that heavily promoted? But he's not. He's a biographer and the head. So this is important. So this institute is hugely important in shaping culture. And why I said, you know, Suki and Tom Hanks and everything, because then you're looking at a system that normalizes the abnormal in a state in the setting of perpetual revolution. So I might even venture to say, without really meaning to defame or malign anyone in particular, I'll just aim this comment at a type of people, that what you're looking at is pigs that have learned to walk on two legs. When you look at a class of people who decide for us how we're to be entertained and what is important to read and what is important to think. Because one of the very, very first stories that I remember catching my awareness, it's early days, you've got about a month or a little bit more than a month of the intensity of propaganda and fear and fear mongering and stories of genuine fear. But in that time, in those early days, I remember reading that Tom Hanks and his wife had been in Australia doing a film. And they got the dreaded C. And the stories were a little conflicting. At first, it was that they tested positive for the dreaded C. And then later stories said, oh, they had the symptoms of the dreaded C. But they were, first of all, hospitalized in Australia. And then they were quarantined in a hotel. And I can just say, you know, being quarantined, the kind of hotel that
Mr. Hanks gets quarantined in.
It's going to be pretty comfortable. But immediately, I have this sense, this reaction to certain stories. It's just like, you know, sometimes it can be simply stated in one word, rubbish. But there are, there's other ways I probably could describe that. But
I've got a good
one
for you. It's fitting with the theme. Hogwash.
Yes, absolutely. And that was my response to that, because immediately I took everything that I knew about Tom Hanks and his wife, Rita, that they were besties of besties with Spielberg and his wife, Steven Spielberg. And that Tom just has a niche in Hollywood of both acting in and producing movies and television, like Band of Brothers, and I can't remember all the names. He's got a new one out this year, 2024, that put war in oh so favorable a light. Oh yes, there's death and there's suffering and so forth, but it's, you know, our boys and patriotism and so forth. And so again, you just question this. And then Ann Patchett goes on to talk about her best friend, the opera singer, or not her good friend, whatever, the opera singer, Renee Fleming. You see, so I'm like, this woman is no longer writing about a life that I can relate to, or you can relate to. We don't hang out with Tom Hanks and his assistant and, you know, the famous opera singer, Renee Fleming, but of course a famous novelist will. And why is she famous? And the answer to that question, not directed at her, but at authorized voices in general, is because they say all the authorized things. They are purveyors, creators and purveyors of propaganda. And you look at people that would say in 2003 that none of Orwell's world, it's a ludicrous representation. Thank God it didn't turn out that way. When, if your eyes are open to reality, you can see that indeed it did.
Yeah. I wonder if the gentleman who you mentioned that died, if he would have changed his tune and at which point, because, you know, I was probably my mid to late teens in the late 90s. So for me, it was a very carefree time. I was playing music in bands. Yeah, I was driving my first car around and chasing girls and had a very easy time of life. We were just getting the internet. We just got Sky TV. It was a very kind of things can only get better type of mood for me. And that was actually the theme tune that the Labour Party picked.
You can walk my path. You can wear my shoes. Learn to talk like me. And be an angel too. But maybe you ain't never gonna feel this way. You ain't never gonna know me. But I know you. I'm singing in our things. It can only get better. It can only get better. If we see it through, that means me and I mean you too. So teach me not a thing. It can only get better. It can only get, it can only get. Take it off of me, you know. I know that things can only get better.
To help get them, Tony Blair's Labour Party here in the UK, they campaigned on that, a song that had that lyric, things can only get better. So but you went
barley mash for everyone.
Yeah. And so I can understand. I had no idea these. I thought having a computer and a laptop was a great thing, and a webcam and a phone with a camera on it, not at all connecting that. Even though I'd read 1984, as I said, it went way over my head at the time, but not even connecting that with the telly screens, always watching you, you know? But I think in this day and age, it is much more overt than it was then, you know, 26 years later, 27 years later. So I'd be interested. I wonder if he would have changed his tune. In the case of the second author you mentioned, I forgot her name already, which is probably a good thing. I don't need to remember it. But Tom Hanks's friend. Exactly. Yeah. They get the fame in return for agreeing to stick to the script, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the way to get any modicum or level of fame in this day and age. And even now I've been having discussions about YouTube channels that reach a certain size. I'm wondering, are they authorized in the same sort of way? Is there things that they will never say? And in return for that, they get hundreds and thousands of followers and so many views on their videos. whereas other channels are strangled, and their numbers are, I don't know what your experience has been, but the numbers I think are just totally cooked. I don't think they bear any resemblance to what is actually going on. So we have no idea who's checking our stuff out and who's responding. I've had people tell me that comments are deleted moments after they're writing them in my chat. And the other thing I noticed about your YouTube channel is there's the notification bell. You can't switch it on. And I don't know if that's a setting you've picked or if that's
No.
something. No, they've just done that to your channel.
Yeah. And there
Wow.
are other odd that, you know, Alan talked, he said, you know, I've been shadow banned for years. And he talked about just things that you know, exactly what you're describing, where numbers are presented. He said, I know that things are very different than what you're seeing. And I don't spend a lot of time monitoring the different channels, but I happened to be on YouTube one day on my channel getting ready to do something, and I saw a video that I had posted recently, and the number I actually did a screenshot then because I couldn't believe it. The number of views was very high, the highest I'd ever had, and I made a screenshot of it. I was like, well, that's wow, I can't believe it. And in real time, as I sat there, that the number changed, it lowered.
That's
And
amazing.
I can't remember where I've saved those. I'll try to find it. But I've seen a few different times where I'm like, wait a minute, you know, yesterday I thought that that had 200 views, and today it only has 165. How did that happen? You know, so,
And then you start questioning your memory. And then you're kind of like, hang on, did I remember it wrong? Am I starting to lose that ability? And just to kind of bring it back to sort of the book and Animal Farm, one of the notes that I made of things I wanted to comment on this topic of culture creation and authorized voices is that the Animal Farm and the revolution, they employ all these methods that are being weaponized and used against us, right? They have a song and they chant it and they memorize it and they sing it. They have a flag, a symbol to symbolize their efforts and their revolution. They have law. It's written on the side of the barn, as we mentioned, and it gets revised. And they have rituals where they parade around and they have a set sequence of actions and a meeting every Sunday, and then they have an authorized version of history which gets changed. Oh, but he that snowball pig, he fought really hard in the battle of the cowshed. Oh, no, he was on the side of the invaders. He was actually working from within to help the invaders, and it was Napoleon that bit into his back and sent him off. And everyone's sort of going, okay, yeah, right, that's fine then. If that's the way it happened, then we'll believe it. And so that's part of why I was saying that it reminded me so much of the Big C event and that whole operation and how things were changed, and in real time the definitions of words were changed, numbers, scary graphs, CGI animations of these red looking fear fearful round balloon things that none of us can see with our naked eye, so we can't check. We just have to take it on faith that these things exist and they're flying around in the air and on surfaces, and you have to wash your hands and you have to be paranoid and scared all the time, right? So very similar tactics that I saw encapsulated in the story arc of this book that I'd lived through very recently. That's what made it so powerful to me. And there was one other thing that I wanted to mention, if you just indulge me for a second, was at the very beginning of the book, Major, there's the old pig called Major something. I haven't got his name, but he's loosely based on Marx and Lenin, right? And he has a vision in his dream, and he gathers all the animals together, and he teaches them the anthem, Beasts of England, and he says, "Do you know what I've realized?" He says, "I can summarize all the problems in a single word." Man. Man is the only real enemy we have. Remove man from the scene, and the root cause of hunger and overwork is abolished forever. Right? And I read that in my copy. And do you know what it reminded me of? This one. If you go to page, let's see, what is it? And this quote, I think Alan
So I
talked about many
just for
times.
people who are hearing the audio version only, He just held up the first global revolution. That's the Club of Rome publication. Man is the enemy. So
Yeah, exactly. And apologize for neglecting the audio
that's
listeners there.
okay.
But yeah, the common enemy of humanity is man. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. And in the end, it says the last sentence of this paragraph is the real enemy then is humanity itself. And I couldn't believe it, the parallel there. When I read that, I thought, goodness me, Orwell was really communicating something to us that, you know, that's two points of reference now for this to back up this agenda and the mentality of these kinds of people who are rolling out and running these revolutionary type scams and schemes upon, you know, a largely unwitting, disinterested, apathetic, because they've been neutered via entertainment population, right? So I just wanted to make sure I got that on the record because yeah, that blew my mind
No,
when I
that's
heard
a
it.
good, that's an excellent. I'm glad that you made that connection between those two books. That's a the real that's a really great observation and connection to make. You know, you said what would this character Russell Baker say if he was alive? And that was a question that I actually asked myself about, or about him, but also about Orwell. Because you can get, we know, I don't think we have time to go into it, but in this version, this edition that I held up, I don't have the publication date. I think it's 2000. Yeah. So this one from 2000, they have put in the back the preface that I mentioned, the unpublished Orwell, The Freedom of the Press. And it's very interesting that he makes, but he's talking about censorship and just what we were discussing with Ann Patchett and but or the whole class of people who understand what they can and can't say. Sometimes it's just intuitive, they just know, and other times it's more directional. And he goes into that here. He talks about who the fact that a lot of times censorship isn't overt, it's not government, it's just the mass mind of that class of people simply know what is going to be popular, what is going to be acceptable, what you can and can't say. And, you know, Orwell's criticism in Animal Farm of the Soviet Union was chiefly aimed at Stalin and Stalin's treatment of Trotsky and abuses that he saw, and also things that had happened to him firsthand. I think he was lucky to get out of Spain alive. He was detained there. Other of his compatriots were actually killed that had gone over there to fight. So he had all of this kind of in his mind. It's not so much that he was a criticism of socialism at all. And that's another thing that you really have to wrap your minds around, is that World War II managed to bring England, it managed to bring the UK into a completely socialized system. They weren't at the beginning, and they were when they came out. And the mood, or the majority mood, it seems to me, was in favor of socialism, and certainly Orwell was. He just didn't like what he saw with the Soviet Union under Stalin. And at the time, this is the reason why this went unpublished. He couldn't find a publisher for Animal Farm. He was rejected repeatedly because the mood in England was pro-Soviet Union, and nobody wanted this. Is, you know, right after the war, this is before the Cold War commences, and Stalin is the friend of the West, and the Soviet Union is the friend of the West, and it was so on the nose, his criticism, that anyone who was living through this would know, oh, he's talking about Stalin. He's talking about the Soviet Union. Nobody wanted to touch it. And he finally found a publisher in a Warburg. And the thing that I didn't have time to check out was to see if he was a banking Warburg, you know, connected to those Warburgs. But at any rate, Warburg published this. And what I kept wondering is if Orwell was alive today, if he had sort of seen the what I call permanent revolution, because it is, it, but it's not just the communistic version. It's the what Alan would describe as the experiment. You've got capitalism, you've got communism, you've got the blending. And so everything that has transpired, even through the periods of prosperity where you're bopping around, I'm bopping around, we're just, you know, enjoying life and our the idea that we have freedom and, you know, fun gadgets to play with, et cetera, et cetera. It's what it takes what it takes for you to see that operating behind this illusion, this propagandized illusion that things are, that you're free, that you're the freest of the free, is something much sinister that has never stopped, that has just kind of been marching forward. And so I kept saying, what would he say about the whole idea of socialism? Because, you know, from hanging out in the chat there at Telegram and all of the things that have been discussed, there is, particularly in the book club chat room, there is the idea talked about regularly of technocracy and end of freedom, not just freedom to move about or say what you want uncensored, but literally going for your mind, your brain, you know, that it's, and this maybe is what is meant by 2+2 is whatever they want it to be. And you not only have to agree, you can't go along to get along. You have to believe that 2+2 is 5. And I think he was bright enough and also willing enough to see through the system and to see how ugly it could be in spite of its promised beauties and promised utopias. I like to think that Orwell would take a look around today and say, totally vindicated.
Told you. Yeah, I think so as well. I think he definitely, I wonder if it was a mix of being around the types of people who were hatching these plans and probably being exposed to that in the same sort of way as the Huxleys were. And I think Orwell, I don't know if whether or not he had some connection with the Fabian socialists. So, you know, George Bernard Shaw and the Webbs and this whole crew. The end goal of all that has always been top-down technocratic control. They just haven't had the systems and the technology in place. And actually, I don't know if I have it over here somewhere, but I got an old pamphlet from 1933, and it's called Technocracy and Marxism. And I've misplaced it. It's somewhere. And I just couldn't believe that, because to me, as a relatively new learner to all these sort of things, I was like, I only learned about technocracy as a word in the last 4 years, but the concept goes back almost 100 years, if not further, and is linked with communism, socialism, Marxism. Socialism is the slow transformation of communism of capitalism into communism. It's by way of infiltration and subversion from the inside peacefully, and communism is the violent smash people over the heads and force it on them way of doing it. And so Orwell, in these circles, his experiences that you just described, analyzing these ways of looking at the world in these modes of thought and philosophies and systems, I'm sure very much saw what was coming. And it's, I was thinking earlier as well, though, about your comments, the comments of the preface talking about how negative, how pessimistic 1984 and Brave New World are. And I wondered why that is. Did they, these authors, were they, did they think, did they know it was all sewn up? and lock and case closed, this was going to happen and nothing could be done about it at that point when they wrote the books? Was it more of a demoralization tactic to prepare people's minds to accept it and think and believe there's nothing that can be done about it so that that makes rolling it out easier? And I do wonder about that with regards to Orwell and 1984. Was it a kind of, this is going to happen, there's nothing you can do about it, and that's why it has the ending that it has, you know?
Oh, that's that is interesting. I wish that I knew more about his mindset, particularly at the very last part of his life. And that the trouble with biographies and authorized biographies is that they always go into it with their own political baggage, and so they oh, but what he really meant and what he was really thinking. But what we do know about him is that he developed a kind of paranoia, if that's the right word, or cautiousness, if it wasn't paranoia. He was living on an island. He was away from people. He didn't want to see anyone. Alan said that he thought that he was fearful of his life. And I'm not sure how Alan knew that, where he'd read that. And unfortunately, I didn't ask that question. Where did you read that? How did you learn that? But he definitely had a cautiousness with other people. And
Interesting, yeah.
yeah. And this is, see, he obviously was known from the time that he published. I can't remember which his first publication was that brought him some renown, but he was writing in the 30s and he was well known, but he didn't skyrocket into fame the way we think of fame until the publication of Animal Farm, which nobody wanted to publish. And but that brought him great fame. And then he wrote the 1984 in the last year of his life. That was published in the, and he died in January of 1950.
Right. Wow.
So yeah, so he and he was young. I think he was only 49 when he died. I don't recall, but he was certainly young. And he had tuberculosis.
And then you
But
wonder about if he was revealing too much, if he was telling too
yes,
much of the plans, and that's what led to his paranoia, and that's what led to his early, untimely, death.
So there, I mean, there are a lot of things that we can't know because, again, that kind of thing. I mean, there's a good movie kind of documentary about him online that I've seen that, but it's put out by probably the BBC or something. So there's so much that you're not going to learn in that, but you can, Alan always says you have to read between the lines, you have to watch between the frames, and just kind
Yeah.
of put things together for yourself. But I do have the sense between reading those two, his seminal works, so to speak, that he did have a feeling that he was prophesying in a way, that he was telling truth as he saw it, that this was not entertainment. I don't think he was creating a fantasy kind of a dystopian novel for the sake of being dystopian. I mean, I don't know. I didn't meet him. I wasn't there.
But
But
it's good
I
to loop
think,
back to our discussion of P.G. Wodehouse as an author who was trying to entertain. He was trying to bring some fun, some lighthearted cheerfulness, hilarious turns of phrase, ridiculous circumstances. Eventually, Jeeves and Wooster were played by the legendary English comics, Hugh Laurie and Stephen
Laurie, yeah.
Fry, you
Yeah.
know, and they have their own show, which is hilarious, just classic British humor and still funny to this day, versus Orwell, who's writing this incredibly, I mean, it must have been hard to write these things. It
Yeah.
must be hard to know that you're going to take people on a journey that is incredibly sad and dispiriting. and pessimistic. Why would you want to do that unless you felt it absolutely necessary and you felt it was very important and it needed to be done and nobody else was going to do it, right?
Yeah, it's and again, this is an example of someone. I mean, you wonder, because he really wasn't, it did not look like Animal Farm was going to be published. He just persevered and persevered. So I think we like to look around and say, well, sometimes something good comes through that isn't totally authorized, because it wasn't like there was no bidding war between publishing houses over this manuscript. And I don't, I suspect he didn't have a huge advance or windfall, because it was such a risk. It was deemed chancy, but it was, it has never been out of print. It's
Wow.
been in continuous publication from 1940. What year was it? 45. It was post-war by the
Yeah, I
time it
think,
got published,
yeah,
but
late 40s.
45 or 46 maybe. So between, say, 1946 to the present, that's a long time to be in continuous reprint. And I don't know the status of 1984, but I like to think that he really did have a vision that was quite dark. And you're right, who would want to inflict that on the world unless you thought that was absolutely necessary? Because, it's anthropomorphized. So he's thinking about people. He's thinking about real leaders and real people sheep who really go along, and they're the first to, just sing it loud. And we see that all the time. It's a tragedy of human nature that.
Yeah, the point about the sheep in the book, and they are constantly chanting this phrase, four legs good, two legs bad. And the audio version I listened to, the gentleman who was narrating did a kind of bleating sheep voice for this, like four legs good, you know. It was so good, this version I listened to, because he did all the voices and he sang the Beasts of England song.
I took a peek when you posted that in the Telegram. I listened to some of that, and I'm like, oh, well, I wish I would have found that earlier in the week when I, after I read it and I wanted to listen to it. Mine was just a wee bit robotic, and then this is an actual real narrator with a great voice who's doing other voices. I'm like, ah.
Yeah, I found it by accident, just lucky, but it's a good one. And what my interpretation of the sheep, and of course that, you know, in the sort of circles we mix in, there's these words thrown around such as maybe normies or NPCs or sheeple, etc. And the sheep in Animal Farm, though, they reminded me of the people who you talk to, and then you realize that you're just talking to the BBC News, probably not the BBC in where you live, but sometimes I'll talk to
CNN,
people
whatever, yeah.
and all I'm getting back is BBC News. And I just think, you just watched that on BBC News at 6 o'clock last night. And that's the repeating of, you hear it and then you know, it goes in from the TV and then it goes out in my conversation when I'm and it's not through reflection or contemplation or coming to that conclusion because I've read widely or I've thought about it for a long time and this is what I think. It's like, download what I'm supposed to say, repeat what I'm supposed to say. And that's, to me, what the sheep represented in this book, because they shouted down the opposition to the dictator. And that's what they were used for. And he told us that Napoleon, the dictator, he wasn't that good at giving speeches, but he did have the foresight to breed the dogs into his personal defense, you know, his security, let's say. And also he was good at campaigning and getting people on his side outside of the debates, particularly the sheep, who would then just repeat this slogan over and over again and basically shut down any conversation or discussion, which is what happens. So you try and raise a point, big C event,
Make
for example.
America great again.
Yeah, that's it. And you just get this slogan that's been planted in people's minds. And it's incredible how well, how many different aspects of human behavior and personality he managed to cram into, what is it, 200-page book? Takes 3 hours to read. It's time.
I think it's 100. I think it's
You're
astonishing.
right.
Okay,
Yeah.
so
191 pages of this guy.
I mean, it's impressive. It's impressive.
Yeah, and that was my interpretation of the sheep. And then one honorable mention I've got to say is to the cat, who was just allowed to be a cat the whole way through. And I thought that was hilarious because the cat just votes for everything, on both sides of an issue, finds the warmest place to sit, and then doesn't listen to any of the political talkings and revolutionary speeches that are going on. And the hilarious part was when they decided that all the wild animals were also comrades. And the cat was sitting on the roof talking to some sparrows, holding out its paw, saying, "Hey, we're all comrades. You can come and sit on my paw if you want to." Just.
I think obviously Orwell knew enough about the animal kingdom to understand that you can't make a cat do anything that's against a cat's nature. That's just well, this has been a lot of fun. Is there anything that you had on your notes that you wanted to mention before we wrap up, or
No, I think I managed to hit all the points
yeah.
here. There was, I was kind of there's so much for you could get into because of all the parallels that he managed to touch upon. You've got Moses the Raven talking about the promised land of Sugar Candy Mountain, just on the other side of
Yes.
the clouds, where we're all gonna die any where we're all gonna go when we die anyway. So, don't worry about what's going on here. There was also the development of the well, kind of, I guess, philosophical system, animalism. And I always like to talk on my videos about all these isms that we're given and how much we buy into these isms without ever really knowing what they mean, what they signify, and having a definition. Yet people can get really up in arms arguing about isms. So I thought it was fantastic that he put an ism in there. And then also, I think the other thing I didn't mention was the commandments, again, touching on this sort of religion, the biblical view being we got 10 commandments, the animals give themselves seven, and then by the end of it's down to one. And that sort of reductio removal of complexity so that it comes down to this one basic bottom what am I trying to say? The lowest common denominator, which ties into what we were saying earlier about when you want to get popular, and popular po to become popular, you have to appeal to the average, and the closer you are at appealing to the average, the more popular you're going to be by definition, because most people are on the average, right? And so the further away you are from the average, the less popular you're going to be, and the less likely you are to get support and listeners and viewers or whatever it is. And that I thought was an excellent encapsulation of just boiling everything down to the average, making everybody the same, getting rid of the differences and the cultural identities and the nuances of personality, and the people who just want to work really hard like Boxer, or the people who just want to prance around and look pretty like the other horse, or the old stubborn donkey Benjamin, who just doesn't get bought. He doesn't buy into any of it. He's like, I'm not getting excited about things getting better. I'm not getting depressed about things getting worse. I'm just stoic, in my attitude. Things are going to carry on being the way they are. So just a real sweeping tour de force of human psychology and human nature in 100 pages, and I just thought it was an absolute fantastic book, and really grateful to you for inviting me to read it and to come on and have a conversation with you, because like I said, I don't know when I would have read it, and it just, like many things, synchronistically popped up at just the right time and gave me a wonderful experience and insight. And I'm so glad that I now have that on my bookshelf, because I didn't have a copy of it before, and now I do. And I will be reading it many more
Great.
times, I'm sure, in the years to come.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I'm glad we did this too. Now, one last question before we go. What is another book that you have not read yet that we should cover the next time we do this?
Oh, that is a great question, but I know the answer.
Oh, okay.
I've never read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Oh, you know, that is so funny that you say that because I was thinking, I bet he hasn't read Brave New World Revisited.
Oh, no. I
And
listened to
so
a
maybe
blurb.
I'll suggest, okay,
Yeah, you
but
mentioned
all
that.
right. Well, we can't do that. We'll have to do Brave New World first. So,
But that's good. We got the next two episodes lined up, and
all
that's
right.
forward planning.
All right. Excellent. It's efficient. It's
Sweet.
technocratic.
Oh no. Yeah, good point. All right, we're gonna have to come up with something left field.
All right, so that sounds good. We will do it. We're committed. We'll do Brave New World. And I haven't, again, I haven't read that book in many, many years. So this will be fun. It'll be good. We'll get it on the books. It's good for me too, because just like when you said you had to start live streaming to keep yourself on a schedule and everything, it's if I make a commitment, then I'm going to do it. But otherwise I go, oh, well, someday I'll get around to
Yeah, I'll buy that book and I'll put it on my shelf and I'll read it
Yeah,
when the time is right. And
that's
then,
right.
yeah.
That's good. Well, Nick, thank you so much for your time and for doing this. It's been a pleasure and a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. And so for listeners and viewers, next week is an episode with Neil Foster. So thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Melissa. I've enjoyed it very much as well. And I'm a huge fan of your work and Alan's work. And I'm very grateful that you're out there doing what you do. And it's an honor and a privilege to have had this conversation with you today. And I look forward to our next one.
Okay, great. And don't forget, we don't want to be popular, so don't forget to thumbs down and unsubscribe. All
Absolutely.
right.
Bye-bye.
Something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away. And I've got something.